Hi, this is Pete Link, and we're back at churchandgospel.com for the Tuesday podcast, where we focus on doctrine, and we help churches think about just who Christ is and what does it mean that Christ crucified, indeed he is Lord of our lives. So today we're very fortunate because in the study of doctrine, we're going to talk about a moment in church history, in world history, and in Protestant history in particular, that is uniquely important in for all of us. And that is, of course, we're going to talk about what happened 499 years ago. And to do that, we're going to bring in our church historian, one of our favorite theologians here at CSU, Dr. Peter Beck.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. Good to be back and talk about something near and dear to my heart, as well as historically relevant, because we have hit a milestone soon.
Yes. 499 years ago, what happened?
Well, next Monday for us today, as we record this, most Americans are going to be celebrating Halloween to the tune of $2.5 billion on costumes.
And how do we get some of that money?
We get none of that money.
Okay.
But more importantly, 499 years ago, on that date or about that date, at an event that happened in a little village at a little never-before-heard-of college, launched what would become known as the Protestant Reformation, and I would argue changed world history. Mm. And in one sense, I think I can say for both the Catholics and the Protestants, it's in many ways the time that God used to save the church, as
That's
both
good.
Sides respond to what went on.
Yeah, so let's draw out a little bit of context of who's involved, what's involved, what are the pressure points. Martin Luther, let's begin with him. Obviously, he's the central figure. Just who is Martin Luther?
Luther is an insignificant nobody from a mining family in central Germany, or what is now Germany. He is, as I laughingly tell my students, the Shrek or the Fred Flintstone of the theological world.
That's a vivid image.
I mean, if somebody's going to say something in a way that's misconstrued or potentially offensive, it would be Luther for
you. There
you
go.
But he's a college student who one day is out in the middle of a thunderstorm, nearly gets hit by lightning, prays out to his patron saint, Saint Anne. If she'll save him, he'll join a monastery. And true to his word, when he got home, he immediately proceeded to Erfurt and joined the local Augustinian monastery there and kept his word to God.
Kept his word to God, went into being a monk. And how would you describe the quality of monk he was?
In terms of monks in general at this time point, illiterate, many of them dysfunctional. The church already knew that. They'd been dealing with it for a couple hundred years. In terms of Luther, he was a miserable monk. He was miserable in the sense that he wasn't very good at it.
Right.
But he was also miserable in the sense that he didn't feel very good at it. He was always afraid that he was not good enough for God. So he's always afraid that God was going to send him to hell in spite of his best efforts. So he'd go to the confessional, and he would spend hours listing every sin he could possibly imagine until one day his confessor, his mentor, John Staupitz or von Staupitz, told him, stop it. Go away, do something worth confessing, and then come back and see me. And so Luther's a pretty bad monk overall.
Yeah, so he clearly, you know, as they did his annual review of the monk job, he didn't score well. But nonetheless, he had an overwhelming sense that he was inadequate compared to God, no matter what he did. No matter what he said, no matter what he thought. So I think that's intuitive, because that seems to be a launching point then when he's sent away, a launching point for where his other thoughts can take root. So what happens to him when he goes away?
Well, von Staupitz wants to help Luther. He likes him and loves him, admires him, sees genius in him. In fact, tries to push him into the law, if you will, within the Catholic Church system. Except he goes to Rome and sees how vile and disgusting things were in Rome and comes back worse off than he was before.
Right.
And so finally, von Staupitz came up with the idea, I need to get him away from the church. I need to get away from the bureaucracy. And so he sends him to a brand new university sponsored by a local prince in Wittenberg, what is now Germany, to be a Bible professor, ironically, having never read the Bible for himself yet.
Right. So that's an interesting way to start your Bible professor career. But nonetheless, he was serious about the work that was put before him. He recognized his own sin. He recognized the flaws in the church and in the world and in Rome. And then he sits down, he begins to open up the scriptures. What did he focus on in the scriptures?
Well, as part of his duties there at Wittenberg, he was teaching Bible to the seminarians there and began to teach through three books. Psalms, Galatians, and Romans. We're not sure of the exact order, but they were among the first three. But it was in Romans that he ran into a problem. In Romans chapter 1, verse 18, it talks about the righteousness of God and the wrath of God being revealed against all the unrighteousness of the world.
That's right.
And so Luther, feeling unrighteous, is now even more convinced that he does not deserve God's favor, God's mercy.
Right.
And so now he's convinced God's going to get him. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, the righteousness of God clearly begins as a weight upon his soul. But what is it that really categorically changes his approach to the righteousness of God?
It actually comes from reading the Bible, strangely enough. You know, people ask, well, why now? Why Luther? Why all of a sudden did somebody discover something or rediscover something in the text that they'd never seen before? Luther is indicative of this generation. Most had not read the Bible. Most priests, something to the tune of like 10%, is all that actually could read the Bible for themselves. So Luther's reading the Bible. And in the reading of the Bible, he comes across, A, the thing that scares him, the righteousness of God and wrath. But in it, in the immediately preceding verse, chapter 1, verse 17, he sees the righteousness of God being revealed through mercy.
That's right.
To those who have faith. And in fact, he cites there, Paul does, Habakkuk 2:4, where it says, the righteous shall live by faith. Mm. And all of a sudden, Luther discovers for himself, rediscovers a doctrine that's been there all along, that the answer to God's wrath is God's righteousness.
So we shouldn't think of Luther as an inventor of this idea of justification by faith, because you use the phrase rediscover. So where else in church history had people talked about justification by faith?
Yeah, Luther's standing on the shoulders of giants. Hmm. I mean, as part of his studies in the university before he himself became a university professor, was reading the law, reading the past history of the Catholic Church. In fact,
right.
This is how they defended their own faith, was by quoting previous theologians. So they, in essence, set him up for this. But he's reading Augustine, for example. Remember, he's an Augustinian monk.
Right.
He's reading the answers of John Cassian, who takes Augustine's thoughts in a different direction. He's aware of Pelagius in the discussion of, you know, free will and sin and original sin. And so Luther's not really adding to the discussion per se, so much as reminding people we've already had this discussion.
Yeah, that's good. So you can almost think of him as the popularizer of this idea rather than the one who created it, right?
Correct. Luther's the perfect storm.
The perfect storm.
Everything that Luther does had been dealt with before. Even his own confessor, von Staupitz, was a believer in justification by faith alone before Luther. In fact, he was a notable theologian of sorts 20 years before Luther becomes a monk. And so the ideas are there. It's just the time was not right. Luther entered into history in God's providence at the right moment, in the right place. The printing press had just come online about the time of his birth in his native lands.
True.
And so the printing press, the ability that he had to teach and so inform young minds, his distance from Rome so that he could operate, if you will, in the shadows for a while as he thinks through his ideas as they germinate, gives Luther time to take old ideas, polish them, refine them, and begin to think how they imply or apply to other areas of thought.
Yeah, so that's important. I mean, we were dealing with a pretty unique person in history. You said that none of his ideas were actually truly original. He's kind of this collision of effects. But what had happened to those who had made similar claims in the preceding years?
Right. This is why I said a few moments ago that, in essence, the Reformation, while the Catholic Church will look at it negatively, because this is when the church split in their mind, the Reformation is really when I think God saved the church.
Right.
The Catholic Church also reforms after this. But in the immediate 100, 150 years before Luther, many of these ideas are already out there. Von Staupitz is already trying to teach justification by faith alone. John Wycliffe in England is already advocating 150 years earlier that we need a Bible in the language of the people so they can read it for themselves.
And what happened to him?
They had him fired from his job. And then Wycliffe had the poor taste of actually dying in jail before they had a time to put him on trial. And so some years after his death, they had a trial. He was found guilty, and they dug up his bones, burned them at a stake, ground them to ashes, and then dumped them into the Thames River so that no one would ever think about Wycliffe ever again.
And somehow we still think about him.
We're still talking about him.
So what the other figure, of course, is Hus.
Yes, Jan Hus, however you want to say it.
Yes.
In the Czech Republic today, they're in Prague, important pastor, Bethlehem Church, well-known, is actually familiar with Wycliffe. Wycliffe is often referred to as the morning star of the Reformation. Hus is aware of his ideas and is trying to implement some of them there in his church.
Right.
This is a little closer to Rome. The Pope and the others catch wind of it. They call him to task for it. They call him to a council to appear before legal authorities to defend himself. They promised him safe passage, that if you come, we'll allow you to go home safely afterwards. He came, he answered the questions, and they reneged on their promise, and they burned him at the stake at the same council that determined Wycliffe was at fault.
Wow. What about the particular situation, though, that then spurred Luther, despite all what had happened to these other folks before, what spurred him to finally act and led to the putting of the 95 statements, the 95 theses against the Roman Church?
Right. Luther's there in Wittenberg. He's teaching his students. He loves his students. He wants nothing more than to read and to teach. He's your typical college professor.
Right.
Let me do my thing. Problem is, in Germany, a political situation arises. Mm. A local bishop, Albert of Mainz, wants another bishopric. He wants another duty. Now, according to church law, you can't do that. But there is a policy in place that we now refer to as simony, after Simon Magus in Acts chapter 8, where if he pays enough fees, he can buy the right to this other job. Now, people go, why does he want two bishoprics? Because when you're the bishop, you collect the tithes and you skim off the top before you send the rest to Rome.
Right.
And so by buying this job, he gets more money for himself.
It's an investment.
It is exactly an investment, except he has to borrow money to buy the job.
Right.
And then the Pope, who is building St. Peter's Cathedral, think Michelangelo painting the Sistine Chapel, all this is swirling around the same time, he needs money to pay for the new building. So he takes the payoff from Albert. Albert borrows it from bankers. The bankers want to be paid back. The Pope wants to be paid all of his money in full. And so he authorized Albert to commission a monk, a guy named John Tetzel, or Johann Tetzel, to go out into the communities near Mainz and sell indulgences. The Catholic doctrine of an indulgence is essentially you pay this or do something, the act of penance, according to the Catholic doctrine of penance, and as a reward or compensation, you might be released from a certain penalty in this lifetime. It's sort of like paying a bail and getting set free.
Right.
Tetzel, however, realized that that's not real appealing to poor people. So he amped it up and made the suggestion that if you buy this particular indulgence, it guaranteed that you would get out of purgatory much faster than you would have otherwise. Or you could buy an indulgence for a loved one who was already there. And so playing on guilt, he's selling them, not salvation per se, but immediately released from purgatory and immediately sent them into the presence of God. Luther says, that's not what indulgences mean. That's not what the Catholic Church teaches. That's surely not what the Pope authorized. And so he writes these 95 theses, 95 points of debate.
Right.
Nails them, at least allegorically, if not literally, to the castle doors in Wittenberg, kind of the community bulletin board, and says, I want to debate Tetzel on these 95 facts, and I want to do it soon.
So the debate, from Luther's standpoint, is directed around Tetzel. And it, if I'm listening correctly, it sounds like it's more a matter of protecting his particular flock than it is turning the world upside down.
Oh, exactly. He does not want to turn the world upside down. He doesn't want to torch the church, so to speak. Mm. In fact, you read several of the comments in there. He's very complimentary to the Pope. He's defensive of the Pope. He wants the Pope to know what's going on in the German territories. He wants to protect his people from basically being fleeced.
Right.
Because somebody else wants a bigger flock.
Yeah, and so that to me is an interesting way that with this smaller motive, what set into motion something that heads in so many different directions. Luther then he makes this or puts these theses up there. Obviously, the word of it spread. I believe you've mentioned that the printing press was there. That obviously enabled the ideas to spread. What happens from that moment forward, not only for Luther himself, but what's happening across Europe at this point?
Well, whether Luther did it or his students, you never know. You know, as I often warn professors or would-be professors, you can only control what you say, not what the students hear.
True.
The students, with or without Luther's permission, took the 95 theses. And according to legend, they took it to the local print shop there in Wittenberg. There was a printing press available. They made multiple copies and sent them out to all the German territories at the time. And so the word quickly goes beyond Wittenberg. Tetzel never shows up. Tetzel doesn't want to debate.
Right.
Tetzel doesn't care. The Pope doesn't care. But as the word spreads back to Rome that there's this little petty little monk in this little village you've never heard of, who's challenging your ability to raise funds this way. At the same time, the German princes are growing more powerful. They're now wondering, you know, do we have to do everything the Pope says? Do we have to send all of our taxes, so to speak, to him? They're also rebelling to a certain degree against the Holy Roman Emperor. Interestingly for us as Americans, he's a child, a descendant Ferdinand and Isabella, okay. the king and queen of Spain, who commissioned Columbus.
Yes.
He's also, though, the nephew of one of the electors, one of the princes in Germany. And so, again, the perfect storm of maybe here's somebody we can influence to protect us from the abuses of the Pope.
Yeah, so it looks like you have a couple different ways you can read this. You can read this about doctrine. You could also hear, perhaps some scholars argue that this is about a rising German nationalism, or at least an idea of separating from the older powers. I mean, how should we as Protestants read and understand what's happening at this time?
I think it is, to use a theological term, God's providence, God providing through all of these things, that it is the perfect moment that what von Staupitz could not do, what Wycliffe was too early to do,
right.
Luther in his time and in his place, in the same way that Christ coming when he did, was the perfect moment in world history for God to accomplish his greater will through it. And so, yeah, there is political issues going on.
Yeah.
Thank you, God. But there are, you know, dynamic, you know, sociological things with the printing press. All of a sudden, social media is a real thing.
Right.
And then you get a guy with some pretty interesting ideas who first is young and enthusiastic and wants to help the church, and then one day realizes maybe the church can't be helped and is willing to put it all on the line to make a difference, at least for his people.
That's right. So this takes us to really, once the news is spread everywhere, what kind of jeopardy does Luther suddenly find himself in?
Potentially, minimum, lose his job, except his prince feels pretty powerful and has a lot of influence, especially with his nephew, the Holy Roman Emperor.
Right.
And so politically, there's danger there for Luther. But the real danger is from the church. Mm. They want to call him to task. They want him to come and defend himself.
Like with us.
Yes. They call him. He refuses to go. They call him to another one. Call him to another council, another gathering. Now, Luther's no fool. He knows what happens when you go to councils. And so even though they promise him, you'll be allowed to come and go freely, we just want to hear you out, he knows a little better now than
right.
the example of Hus will allow you just to forget the church's promises in the past. And so, in one sense, his vocation's on the line. He could lose his job. Mm. Ultimately, he could lose his life. And then spiritually, what ultimately comes of it is he's going to be excommunicated from the Catholic Church. And theologically speaking, since the Catholic Church argued that there is no salvation outside of the church, to be kicked out of the church,
right.
it's possible that Luther could lose his soul in the process as well.
So there's, I mean, this is the weight of the entire Western world is beginning to be pushed against this one small, meager monk, the Shrek of monks, as you called him. When do things finally collide?
It all comes to a head really in 1520.
1520, okay.
Luther gets busy. He's now moving further away from the idea of helping the church to it's beyond help.
Right.
And so he begins to establish his thinking where he's now starting to be a little more vocal about criticizing the Pope, the particular Pope on office at the moment, as well as the office. Hmm. He's going to start pointing out some flaws in their theology and their practice. And so in 1520, he actually publishes what are referred to as the three treatises or three tracts, which to modern evangelicals sounds like a little 16-page evangelism piece. They're actually significant books, probably totaling about 450 pages
wow.
in the span of 1 year. And it's these writings that the Pope says, yeah, this guy is an outsider, and we need to deal with him. And so they order him to stop and desist, and he doesn't. And so he receives an excommunication, a papal bull saying, you're out. At which point, he in essence mocked the Pope and cast it into a fire and burned it.
Wow.
You can't kick me out if I quit.
Yeah, you didn't fire me, I quit, right? So this is this means that the conflict is obviously building for him personally, for the church. The stake for the Pope is high. I mean, if you were a betting man, clearly you would have bet with the Pope. But yet, what keeps Luther going?
Well, again, spiritually, when I say God kept him going, you know,
sure.
pragmatically speaking, historically looking at the events, I think it's the boldness. I mean, Luther is growing. This man who was timid, who had extreme anxiety as a monk, is now sensing perhaps the importance of the moment, if not himself.
Right.
Perhaps he is going to be that sacrificial lamb that makes a difference for the church. And so he grows bolder. Now, of course, the princes are growing bolder as well.
Right.
They're starting to run interference for Luther. So they've got his back, so to speak. And finally, one day, it all comes to a head when he's called to a diet, a small council in the city of Worms, where he's taken to task. Here are your writings. Are these yours?
And he's given a choice, right?
Yeah, he demurs. He says, I'm not ready to denounce my writings because I don't remember what all I've said. I've been rather prolific. I'm also not willing to say that I'm going to recant because some of those things I might still believe. So he asks, they give him permission. He gets a night off to rethink it. Of course, they want him to recant, to announce that he was in error, to admit he's guilty. He knows what happens when you do that. He goes back to his room. He prays. Comes back the next day motivated. He's asked the same question again. Do you recant your writings? Luther, again, demurs to a certain degree. I've written many things. Some of them were important. Some of them were, however, importunate. They were not things I should have said out loud.
Right.
You know, things that were perhaps improperly motivated by anger, inflaming. But he says, but the heart of the matter, I believe what I've written. And he ultimately says, according to legend, there's no proof that he actually said this, but he ultimately makes the argument, unless you can convince my conscience with scripture or with reason, there's no way I can recant these things. And so he famously said, so here I stand, I could do no other, mic drop, and walks out and leaves the room in awe.
It is kind of a mic drop moment because at that, when he makes that stance, he is, in essence, signing a death certificate, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's convinced he's not going to make it home. In fact, on the way back to Wittenberg, he's kidnapped. He assumes that it's the Roman Catholic authorities. They let his buddy who was traveling with him run away. He spreads that rumor. So everybody assumes Luther's dead and gone. It's actually his prince has had him kidnapped and taken to one of his castles up on top of a mountain to protect him. Kind of a protective exile in this case.
There you go.
And then God, in turn, in his providence again, uses that to even further the Reformation farther.
Because he does what while he's in this semi-prison, so to speak?
He does the unthinkable. He does what Wycliffe wanted to do. He translates the Bible into the language of the people.
At least the New Testament at first, right?
At least for New Testament at first, then the Old Testament in short order. In fact, take this into context. The German language is not unified at this point.
That's right.
Every little village, every little province has their own unique spin on it. And because most people are illiterate, it's not written down. Most things in writing are still in Latin. So Luther has to create, in essence, the written German language, as well as translate the Bible from the Greek, which he got, by the way, from Erasmus, a Catholic theologian who had just done that, as well as using Latin sources, translates the entire New Testament in a matter of like 3 months.
Which is a quick pace.
Yes, considering most of us won't read the entire New Testament in 3 months, and then sets his sights on the Old Testament, which takes a little bit longer, but it's a bigger volume of work.
Yes, yes. So if think about this, and this is kind of where we're going to have to end our podcast, because you can keep talking about Luther forever. One man stood in the gap. He was a flawed man. He didn't necessarily have perfect ideas, but at the right time, in the right way, at the right place, he stood up to where the gospel had been denied. And, of course, that led to what we know as the rest of the Protestant Reformation and all the conflict that ensued there. And so I think we always, Dr. Beck, want to take history and reduce these men to either larger-than-life heroes or larger-than-life villains. Now, clearly Luther is as close to larger-than-life as anyone could get, but how do you think we should frame Luther?
Oh, Luther is, you know, to use a colloquialism, a hoot. He is larger than life.
Right.
He is a genius. He becomes bold. You know, this meek, almost wimpy monk takes on the world. And while you might argue he didn't win, he at least brought it to a draw.
There you go.
And so here in the course of history, this monk in an unknown place, in an unknown town, at a little irrelevant university, changes the course of history. Not sure. Just for the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church. Think of the missions and the ministries that have all come out of either side of the Reformation because of what Luther did. And so he is a giant. And just like we do in America, and we respect our veterans, for example, on Veterans Day, we remember those who've died before us on Memorial Day. I think Reformation Day, October 31st, is a good reminder for us not to worship Luther. He's not a saint in the capital saint sense. Mm-hmm. He's a flawed man. But God used this flawed man in a way that altered the course of history. And for those of us on the Protestant side of the Reformation, we need to thank God for that.
That's right.
Because while some today will deny they're Protestants, either you're a Catholic or you're not still. And so as a Baptist, I am a Protestant in the big sense. I am still protesting against that particular theological system by my absence from it.
That's right.
And so we need to thank God for Luther. thank God for his mercy and his grace, and to thank God that, in essence, he saved the church. Mm. Not from the bad Catholics, but from bad theology, bad traditions that had gotten in the way of the gospel. And through Luther, basically reopened the door, if you will, for salvation by faith alone, in a way that the last 500 years now could have never been repeated otherwise.
Yes, so that to me is an important thing. God is using a flawed man, but that's what God has always done. And indeed, whatever one might think of Luther, he certainly had an idea of Christ crucified that shaped him, and therefore that was used to shape the world. So that has been an explosive discussion. Dr. Beck, thank you for joining us. We're going to keep talking about some ideas that have flowed out of the Reformation in the upcoming Tuesdays. So join us every Tuesday as we discuss doctrine at churchandgospel.com. We'll see you next week.